Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Jordan Tuck is with us. He's a young engineer, and he's amazingly good at refurbishing older gear. All the stuff he refurbishes, most of it's older than he is, and yet he does a great job of it. He's got some great mentors, and he's going to give us some tips about refurbishing older gear. Coming up next on Torts. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we're talking about everything eventually, from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. That's why I'm surrounded by Telos Alliance gear everywhere I go. In fact, just across the room from me, you can't see it, it's not on camera, but just across the room, I've got this cool new Telos Alliance IQS virtual audio console. It's like virtual? You mean like it's not there? No, it's software that runs, and it's a console. So I'm surrounded by this stuff, and I'm so delighted to be here. We're going to be talking today, though, about consoles and other equipment that is not virtual at all. It's very much purpose-built with our guest. So let's, without further ado, bring our guest in, Jordan Tuck, my new friend, and glad to have met him. Jordan, welcome into the show.
It's an honor to be here. It really is.
Well, it's an honor to have you on. Tell us a little bit about your passion and specialty, and then we'll begin to delve into it.
I just like audio equipment of all kinds, and lately it seems like I've taken a special interest in broadcast equipment because there's lots of it around, and it can be had for cheap usually. And look at this stuff. It's a lot of fun to work with. It really is.
You've got a PR&E console there right now. Which model is that?
It's an AMX 18. Found this at a transmitter site one time.
So oh my gosh. Day. How much did it cost you?
A couple ride bucks home, in gas.
Right?
Yeah.
And we're going to get to the story.
It was raining.
We'll get to the story of that PR&E AMX 18 in a few minutes. Let's cover something. You actually, you're employed, or you work sometimes or all the time for another gentleman who's been a guest here on this show, and that's Mike Patton. Tell me about that situation.
He's a good guy. I work at Michael Patton Associates, and predominantly what I do there is a lot of audio. So any processors or speakers or audio equipment, you know, whatever it may end up being, usually hits my bench, and I'm still learning the RF side of things. So it's a really fun experience, and we've got a lot of really cool retrofit products we're working on. I've been doing a lot of work with that as well, mostly just stuffing parts and testing, but it's a lot of fun to work there. He's a good guy. He's very knowledgeable and very patient to have me around. That's for sure. So,
well, Michael is, I'm sure, a great teacher. He has a vast, vast amount of knowledge. And you mentioned stuffing parts. And one of the things, I've had a number of conversations with Mike Patton. He's done some work at our radio stations. And once in a while, he mentions, hey, I can retrofit this, or I can retrofit that with a board or a circuit that replaces the original, and it's better, and here's why. Talk to me a little bit about some of the things that Mike Patton has invented to retrofit into older gear. It was covering a weak point that some piece of gear had, and now it makes it more reliable.
Sure. So one example of many that we have are the retrofit displays for like an SX1. You know, most of these SX1 transmitters have a really small display. The actual cutout's pretty large, but it's got this numeric display in it, and it's most of those are unobtainium now. Most of them are dying. And if your display is not in and put a drop-in replacement board that literally just plugs in, and it's full graphics, it's got our logo on it. It even, you know, for each reading, it even gives you a little hint. You know, like the Vizwer, lower is better. It's kind of funny, but you know, it really is. I mean, lower is better for your Vizwer, I guess. But it shows you all of your readings, and you don't have to decode it either. It's just plain and simple.
It tells you what it is. You mentioned the SX1. That's the Harris SX1 AM transmitter, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's an AM transmitter.
I used to take care of a few of those. In fact, I remember back in Memphis, I took care of a couple of the SX 2.5s. And listen, not to take away from your story at all, but I'll tell you, one of these SX 2.5s was on 1430 AM, which at the time that transmitter was purchased, it was owned by the legendary Sam Phillips. The same guy who started Sun Records, the same guy who first recorded Elvis Presley. Yes. And Mike Patton may have a story or two about Sam Phillips. I don't know. A lot of similar stomping grounds. And so, of course, Sam was the kind of wheeler dealer guy. He'd bring a wad of money to the NAB show and he'd go to the Harris booth and he would say, "Nah, I'm going to take that one home right there. And I want a discount." So he brought home SX 2.5s. And I remember that the displays that you're speaking of, these are the red numeric. They weren't alphanumeric. Yes. They were numeric displays. And they came in the form of a dual inline pin chip. You know, it looked like a chip, except instead of being black with some silver writing on it, it was red. It was a package that had a red front on it, and the display would shine through it. But the whole thing plugged in like an IC, right?
They're really cool to look at, too, if you have a dead one. I actually have one in my car on my dash that rolls around and falls in the floor every once in a while. But I just think they're really cool looking. I mean, the thing's dead. Why not hang on to it just for the looks or whatever? But, yeah, they're really cool looking little display chips, but they're really expensive, apparently. I've never tried to source one out. I just know that they're hard to get.
Well, so, now, I was taking care of that transmitter literally back in 1988, 89, 1990, around that era. And
I'm sure they were plentiful then.
Well, yes and no. So when I first started working at the station, the FM was WEZI. Oh, WLVS for Elvis. WLVS was the call letters of 1430. And the reason they had two of them, they had separate day and night transmitter sites. So the day site was co-located with the FM and the studio. The night site was a 6-tower array in Bartlett, Tennessee. And it was unfortunately close to a water tower, so that caused problems with the pattern. Yeah. But that's why they had two of these transmitters. So, you know, I made plenty of money keeping those transmitters going with, you know, blown transistors and, the ventilation fan that would lock up eventually and all kinds of little things. But these displays, and hey, a lot of you engineers watching the show, you know what I'm talking about if you've taken care of an SX-1, an SX-2.5, and didn't that come in a 5-kilowatt version too, an SX-5?
Yes. Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so these displays, so they, when I first took over engineering there, a bunch of the segments were out or the whole display was out. So I got to looking them up, called Harris, and they wanted a king's ransom for these displays. I want to say they wanted something like 40, 50 bucks a piece for them, and I had to replace a dozen. So that would have, you know, that would have been $600 for the parts right there. So I think I went to Mouser or DigiKey or maybe Aero Electronics, one of those, and I found the same part for, I want to say they may have cost me $9 or $10 each, and I probably bumped them up 100%, you know, and so on a regular basis we were replacing them. But you're right, eventually these are going to be made of non-obtainium. And so the thing that Mike designed and that you put in, is this a single screen or is it individual displays? What's it look like?
It's a single LCD display, like literally in the exact same size of the cutout. Oh. If you look at the front of the transmitter, there's a little plexiglass window and it's the same size as that. So instead of just being a little tiny digit right in the middle of the screen, it's full size, full color too, backlit.
Oh, okay.
So it's really fun to work on.
Well, somebody had to design some firmware to go between, right? Whatever the transmitter wanted to feed it and what you wanted to see. Mm-hmm. Who wrote that software?
I'm not sure. I think that was Lynn, and he's another employee of ours that I actually haven't met yet. I think that was between Mike and Lynn, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mike has talked to me about, oscillator boards for certain transmitters to make them, you know, to stay on frequency. Things like that.
Yeah, we've got retrofits for those as well.
Good deal. Well, we're going to, coming up, Jordan, you and I are going to talk about not only the PRNE AMX 18 that's in front of you, but also some stories about a Sparta audio console. And those of you who've been around long enough, you know them and probably don't love them. But we got a story about that. ITC Delta Cart Machines, reel-to-reel decks. You've got one right there near you. Also, you're going to tell us about an Ampex ATR 700. What a classic that was. Orban 8000s, Texar Prisms, the DAP, the Discriminant Audio Processor. We're all your favorite hits, right? Of your favorite audio gear from the 70s, some 80s, 90s. Yeah, some of them favorite. Yeah.
It's a big list of favorites.
It's a big list. All right, that's coming up. And what we're going to find out, folks, from Jordan is I want to understand two things. Number one, how can somebody so young as Jordan, and he tells me he's in his mid-20s, how can somebody as young as Jordan develop this passion for fixing older equipment that's every bit of it is older than he is? Everything he works on practically is older than he is. And he seems to have this really good sense of how to restore it. And, you know, how has he become at least somewhat expert and had a sensibility about restoring things to their original operating condition or maybe a little bit better? So I'm curious about that. And maybe me as an older engineer, maybe I can learn something from Jordan and come to appreciate what he sees in restoring this older gear. I do like to look at the past with rose-colored glasses sometimes myself, and I love the look and feel of the stuff that I've worked with. But hey, we're going to take a quick break right now. We're going to check in with our sponsor, Broadcast Bionics. Hang on, we'll be right back.
X-Screen 2, the simply amazing new way to control, screen, and log calls using your Telos HX6, IQ6, or VX Talk Show systems, helping you to get the best calls to air quickly and easily. X-Screen 2 is a powerful touchscreen interface that connects alongside your VSET 6 or VSET 12 handsets, and even enables you to screen directly on your PC using a USB headset or sound card. X-Screen 2 clearly displays the status of lines and hybrids, quickly captures caller details for screening, and automatically stores a log of calls and easily manages station and show directories of important numbers. There's also a scheduling clock and chat window for instant messaging and visual talkback to other X-Screen workstations on the system. As soon as a line rings, the caller's name is displayed, if they've rung before, and we can look up their location. X-Screen also usefully shows how many times they've called before and when they last called. You can add alerts to identify nuisance or persistent callers before you've even answered the call. To route a call to the VSET or headset, simply click on the handset symbol, exactly as you would use the button on the VSET. Using the other icon on the line, we can hold the call or route the call to a hybrid. Selecting an alternative device will change the icon key so you'll always know the destination of the call. The tabs on the right-hand side provide more information and control the selected caller. We can add this caller to a caller directory or create a manual entry for someone we call regularly. Calling someone is as simple as just clicking dial on their entry. A free version of X-Screen is included with your HX6, IQ6, and VX Talk Show system. The full version of the software enables the caller database, directories, and alerts, and other cloud-based features. All Telos customers can try the full version for 3 months by downloading the free trial. More information is available by contacting Broadcast Bionics or your local dealer.
Awesome software from Broadcast Bionics and X-Screen. And you can download that directly from their website and other Broadcast Bionics products, including visual radio systems, all kinds of good stuff are available at Broadcasters General Store at bgs.cc. Jordan, do you ever deal with call screening software yourself?
No, not a whole lot, but I'm sure I will over time. It's going to happen, I'm sure.
I had the opportunity a couple months ago to do some work for a huge corporate event with literally thousands of people involved, and they wanted to take phone calls. So I helped them set that up temporarily, and we used X-Screen, and I kind of had to learn it myself in about an hour, and then I had to train somebody else on how to do it, and it worked fabulously, really fabulously. I was just delighted with it, and it works great with a touchscreen. So X-Screen. Remember, X-Screen, use it with a touchscreen, and you can use it with a mouse too, but with a touchscreen, you just touch the screen, a call you want to take, right? Hold, screen hold, all that works great. All righty. I'm not sure where you want to start. Why don't we start with the console you have in front of you? Because that's got some story behind it. It's this beautiful PR&E. For those of you new to the business, that was for Pacific Recorders and Electronics.
Let me see if I can get it.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Let me see if I can try to get it into the picture. I'm running into a mic stand here with the computer.
That's all right. I can see enough of it. So I'll shut up. You tell me the story about this console and how you got it and what you had to do to it.
Okay. So I was at a transmitter site with a friend. That friend is John Clark in Thomasville. And I don't know if he's tuned in or not, but if he is, hello. We were at a transmitter site and I saw this, and it was one of those things like, you know, I'll go to a transmitter site or whatever, and I'm always looking for gear. Not really because I need anything, because I really don't, but I saw it sitting there. It's actually was sitting on its side behind a huge trash can. And, you know, generally I try to keep a poker face when I see equipment and not freak out, because usually the equipment I come across is either boring or really awesome. There's never any middle ground. This was awesome because this is the first one of these I ever saw in person. And, you know, I went from like seriously quiet to, oh my gosh, what is that? Why is that here? Where's the power supply? Because I couldn't find the power supply at first. And we found that somewhere else. But long story short, we ended up actually loading it into the truck and in the rain, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was raining. So the thing was getting wet, but didn't really hurt it. Kind of a stressful moment. You know, you find this new console that you've always seen in pictures and videos and, you know, air check videos back in the day, like on YouTube or whatever. And you're like, wow, I wish I had one of those. And, you know, to see it finally in the back of the truck and you're taking it home and, you know, that's really the story. I just found it at a transmitter site in the rain, took it home, let it dry out, plugged in the power supply. That didn't explode, thankfully. Mm-hmm. I know that these have a tendency to kind of not want to come back after they've been off for a long time. And basically what I did, very nervously, because I had never dealt with one of these before, I took all the channels out, and I'll actually move the camera again real quick, just briefly so you can see. I would take all the channels out, light the power supply up. Ooh, the lights came on the power or the meter bridge, all one, you know, bulb that's left that isn't burnt out at that time. And yeah, there was about one bulb left. I was even surprised that even worked.
That was there.
Because this thing has had a ton of hours on it, I'm sure. But anyways, I would plug, you know, turn off the power supply, plug in the one mic strip, and I'd back up and I'd get over here and I'm like, turn the power switch on to the power supply, and it would come up and I would have a source plugged into it, and I saw the meters moving, and it was a good time. So I was like, let's do two
fader strips.
Input, yeah. Channel strips. Yeah, fader strips, whatever you want to call them. And I would do the same thing over and over again. And all of a sudden, pow, you know, plug one in and, you know, tantalum caps exploding or whatever, or it wouldn't come on.
That smells bad. Yeah.
No, it's not a good smell. And I found out that tantalum capacitors make like a red smoke that's really cool to look at, but not fun to smell. This thing was easy to work on. It's a lot of capacitors, probably 25 caps per channel strip, and that's 18 channel strips. And of course, you got your line output amps here. You got your mix minus modules over here, your EQs, your VU meter drivers, your clock modules. It's a lot of caps, but I think it was worth it, you know, especially for free. And it only exploded like four times. So we're good.
Did you replace lot of the caps?
I replaced all of them, every single last electrolytic and every single tantalum.
Oh my gosh.
I don't want to see that. Yeah, that's all. It's not that much money. I don't want the red smoke escaping from the channel strips again. That was, I have a video of that somewhere. I'll send it to you at some point, but it's funny because you just see the red smoke slowly rolling out of the back of the console. And it's pretty cool looking. But yeah,
wow.
Lots of LED replacement bulbs, a few replacement switches, a couple faders. The thing I'm having trouble finding for it are channel blanks, you know, just the basic piece of metal that goes in between channel strips, because do I have 18 sources in the studio? No. But, you know, I'm not really complaining. At one point, I was with a BMX 14 and I didn't have enough inputs, and then I decided to cut the desk out even more and put this in, and then I scaled down all my inputs. So, you know, here in the studio, I only have two mics. The reel-to-reel, the turntable, some cart machines, which are not here at the moment, and three computers and a few other things. So not 18 channels worth, but it's still fun to sit here and move all the faders and see all the meters moving. It's a lot of fun.
You know, here at my office, I've kind of, I like to have some audio sources that just go all the time. And one of the things I've done is I've found some inexpensive AM FM receivers plus HD, and I rack mounted them and I leave them tuned up, and then I take their audio outputs and I run them into my Axia Livewire network here at the office. So now I've got, you know, a number of different radio stations and some audio from one of my own stations off of the Zip One. And that just stays on my Axia network all the time. So I can bring up these constant sources. At least that adds four, maybe five sources here in my own office.
That's cool. If you take a look at my office at work, it's not Axia, but it's more PR&E stuff. I have a little BMX10 that's there, and it's got inputs to it. Just, it's better than an iPhone playing music on the desk when I can have VU meters going and compressors and limiters back here going, and, you know, yeah.
When that console was designed and built, you mentioned light bulbs, and indeed they used filament, you know, Edison light bulbs, right?
Yes,
I'll burn them. But you have, I've seen you post other pictures of you replacing meter light bulbs with LED strips. Tell me about how you found out the right colors to use and to get a proper amount of brightness. Tell me about that process and what you found that works well.
Lots of trial and error. They do make bulb retrofits, if you will, that you get like on Mauser or superbrightleds.com is who I use for most of these buttons. But I wanted to try something kind of cheap and inexpensive and close. And so I actually went to Batteries and Bulbs, you know, the store that's like on every corner in every city in the U.S. pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they have these automotive LED 12-volt, you know, taillight bulbs, and they're built of little tiny LED segments, and I'll send you some pictures of what they look like. And what I would do is desolder those and take them apart and then, you know, glue them to a backing board, you know, instead of using the socketed bulbs, which have hot spots, and these meters are still physical bulbs, so there's three hot spots above the meter where the light is not diffused perfectly. It's good enough. I think it's cool looking, but those LED strips spaced apart just right, lots of trial and error with the color temp too, makes a really even, nice, bright meter illumination. I've done that on some autograms, several LPBs, a couple of these PR&Es, a couple of reel-to-reel machines, and it works great. Literally all it is just little LED strip modules that float above the top of the meter movement itself. So I got that idea from a friend, Steven, in Florida. He said he used LED strip lighting, and I was like, I've never thought of that. I mean, it sounds super simple and easy. And instead of buying the strip LED tape, I just went to Batteries and Bulbs and started buying these little $10 or $15 LED replacement automotive lamps and taking them apart and hanging the strips above the meter. So works really well. It's a lot of work for some lights, but
to replace the bulbs that are in the switch in the buttons, the on off buttons there, are there direct replacements that you pop in instead of a filament bulb? Okay.
Yep. They pop right in. I don't know the part number offhand. Scotty Ricewood, he's the person that told me about these, and it's so much better. The thing runs cooler. The power supply went from I can barely touch it to, you know, I can actually touch it. The heatsink's cool enough now because of all the current consumption of all the filament lamps has been replaced by LEDs that, you know, pulled hardly any current at all.
I'm glad you mentioned Scotty Rice. He posts pictures of things that he refurbishes as well. So shout out to Scotty. You do a great job too. Well, you guys would be you guys would be dangerous together, apparently.
I still have yet to meet him. That's supposed to happen soon. So
something else I want to talk about on that very console, if we take you full screen and you want to move the camera around again, is the I believe they're called Shadow switches. Shadow may be the brand or the model of switches, but it's the I think they're the maybe used for A and B inputs and for bus assignment or something. These are the ones where they have a little aperture, a little aperture,
it's
that
like
opens
a little
up
door.
When you push it down. A door that opens up. Tell me about those Shadow switches. Yeah. And did you have to replace some or not?
I didn't. I only had to clean the contacts. When I first got this, they were kind of stuck where they've been, you know, selected one particular way for however long the console was not in service.
25 years.
Maybe so. Maybe just a couple of years. I don't know. I don't exactly have a line of how long this thing sat. But no, I didn't have to replace any of the Shadow switches on this AMX. Now, the BMX that I had before this, which is half the size of this, Those are also shadow switches, but they're a little bit bigger and they're the older style, and those were coming apart. I think that console was from 1980, 1979, so it was getting up there and it had been used and abused. This one looks mint, so I was really lucky to find something like this in this type of shape for free and didn't have to replace a bunch of stuff on it except for the caps and the bulbs and stuff.
So there's
shadow switches everywhere.
Because they're a great indicator of, do I have this button pushed or not? You could really, really tell easily. PR&E would advertise. I remember when they used to advertise their equipment, they would say, design first and then priced. In other words, basically they were saying, look, we know our stuff's expensive. We put the best parts in here so that you won't have a failure. What have you found about that console that you either particularly like or appreciate, like, wow, they did a great job on this, or be like, you know, I don't think they had enough foresight, or maybe they didn't plan on this console lasting 30 years before it would fail. What was a strong point and what was a weak point?
There's so many strong points to list. It's just a great console. It's spread out and laid out in such a way that it's logical for someone like me to operate, and I don't get confused. Oh my gosh, I forgot to select the audition bus, or oh my gosh, right, I forgot to turn that off or whatever. It's simple. It's reliable. It's DJ proof for the most part. You could probably spill a coffee in this and it would probably not like it, but it'll survive versus, you know, I don't know. But yeah, I think the only weak point that I could come up with is just age. This stuff's getting old. Finding certain integrated circuits, like in the logic circuitry, is kind of hard because some of that stuff just hasn't existed in so long. But I mean, works. There's no problems until the thunderstorms come around. But that's another story.
You mentioned replacing capacitors, electrolytics, and tantalum caps. What about solid state components? Did you have many or any solid state components to replace?
Not a single op amp was bad in this when I found it. I was really surprised. I would expect to see a couple of input op amps maybe have failed or whatever, but no, not a single problem. Not a meter driver, not a headphone amp, nothing. It just works. So whoever had this before me, obviously, I guess, appreciated it enough to, I don't know, maybe they just kept up on the maintenance. Maybe it has blown up before in the past.
Yeah.
It'll blow up in a minute. I don't know. But yeah, no solid state components needed to be replaced, just passive components like caps, and that's pretty much it. And a lot of deoxit,
Gotcha. Yep. Okay. Okay. What about the, and deoxit, I guess, is your choice of chemical to restore electrical contact.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
Yep. No complaints there.
What about the fader movements themselves? There's a word that somebody came up with, stiction? Actually, stiction also applied to tape and tape heads, but were they sticky, and did you fix that?
At first, they were kind of sticky where they wouldn't want to move. Like, there's a little, I don't know if I'm explaining this correctly, because P&G, who makes these faders or made these faders, they made multiple versions, and I believe these have a little rod in the middle, and there's nylon bushings inside that do wear down over time. So, you know, when they were new, they were really easy to move. These are pretty easy. They don't squeak or rub or anything, but it's just cleaning them. They had a bunch of crap down in them and probably DNA and coffee and Coca-Cola and all that, I'm sure, and Lord knows what else. For lack of better terms, that I didn't really have to do much to these to make them nice and smooth again.
Cool.
I mean, it's built to last, really is.
I'm sure there's DNA and down in there. No forensic analysis was done in terms of that.
Yeah, when I first got this, I wore gloves and I vacuumed a lot. And there's been more than one time where I put a channel strip in the dishwasher.
Oh,
I'm not saying whose dishwasher. I will not admit, but yeah, you can do that. Take the fader out because the faders don't like water that much. But, you know, put the whole channel strip in the dishwasher and wash the Coke out of it and dry it really well. Hose it down with some deoxit.
So I've heard of doing this. Now, I've never put actual electronics into a car washer or dishwasher. I have taken all the electronics out of a console and taken the tub, you know, the whole tub mm-hmm. to the car wash in the pickup truck and really cleaned it out at the car wash. You know, probably ended up with some if Tom Morris is watching, with some tricolored foaming wax, TCFW.
Oh yeah,
and of course I wasn't washing electronics. So you've actually washed electronics, but you've taken out the mechanical thing that would probably be sensitive to soap. What kind of soap did you put in there?
Anything. I didn't. Just anything that had the ability to store moisture, like the faders and certain potentiometers, like the Mod Pots up here. I think these are Mod Pots or some version of a sealed potentiometer. Water can get in there and really wreak havoc. So anything like that that I was worried that might store moisture, you know, take it off and clean it separately. The switches all come apart right here. Pull the bulbs out. And of course, as long as you can get air in there, like compressed air and contact cleaner, you're good. But yeah, if there was gunk or something on these channel strips, and there was a few channel strips that had some nastiness to them, like just an oily film, and I didn't know what it was, and I was concerned. And so, you know, I'd wash it, and it was just, you know, perfectly clean. No problems. Yeah, I could put a channel strip in a dishwasher. Don't do that with your wife around.
Did you do that with the dishwashing heating cycle or not?
No, just cold water. I've never tried the heating cycle. I don't know how hot it gets. I don't know if it would warp anything, but
yeah,
it'd probably be just fine. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, cool. Hey, tell you what, we're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna tell the story about Sparta AS30B console, and a lot of you had Sparta consoles, so they were inexpensive and cheap too. So we'll have a story of Sparta. I couldn't believe when you said that you had rebuilt a Sparta console. I thought of, oh my gosh, when I started in radio at a public radio station,
that's where it started.
The production room. Yeah, the production was a Sparta console. Hey, it's This Week in Radio Tech. We're talking to Jordan Tuck from Louisiana. Didn't say where you're from Louisiana. And Jordan's loves to rebuild vintage equipment, and he does a great job of it. And so I want to talk to him about that. Our show is brought to you in part by Henry Engineering and this little box right here, the Henry Superlight. Now, you know, as engineers, we've probably used plenty of the Henry Super Relays. And, you know, that box would take a contact closure from your audio console and give you a lot of relay outputs. It would also light up a 110-volt console to run to your on-air lights. Well, things are different now. You know, on-air lights are not always 110 volts anymore. Most of them nowadays are LED-based, and they don't need 110 volts. You can light them up with 12 volts. Well, the Henry Superlight is like the super relay meant for today's studios. Now, it'll take a 12-volt DC power input right here. It'll also take a contact closure of normally closed, normally open, either way, to light the light. Ah, there we go. There's some information about it on screen. And it also gives you two sets of dual pole double throw contact closures. So you have a normally closed and you have a normally open contact closure plus a center that wipes between those. So all that is built in. It'll supply 12 volts at 500 milliamps to light up your light. If you need more than that, though, you can supply your own external power, 12 volts at up to 2 amps. So your own external power can be added to that. I'm sorry, 30 volts at up to 2 amps. If you need to really light some LEDs, or you have some LEDs that take more than 12 volts, no problem with that. The other cool thing about this is you see the control link IO. That's two RJ45 jacks. You can daisy chain these together. If you have your contact closures for your studios in one place, maybe from a GPIO node, from your vendor that makes audio over IP systems. You have a GPIO node with all your contact closures, and you can have these super lights in each studio and just run Cat 5 between them. You can run, I think it's up to six studios you can put into series, and it just makes wiring easier. You go inside the Henry Superlight and you set the jumpers for which studio number, which, you know, pair number, which wire number you're going to be using from Henry Engineering, the Henry Superlight. It's called an LED Tally Light Controller. Go to henryeng.com to see this and all the other Henry Engineering products. And, of course, you can get this from Broadcasters General Store, bgs.cc. I love these folks. 352-622-7700. for Broadcasters General Store. Just awesome, folks. And order you a Henry Superlight from there. Thanks a lot, Henry and BGS, for sponsoring this part of the show. All right, we're talking to Jordan Tuck on This Week in Radio Tech. Jordan Tuck is here from Louisiana. We're talking about refurbishing gear. I got interested in Jordan's work because he posts some of his best work on Facebook. And I thought, man, that's pretty cool. Somebody's taking the time to do this. Jordan, is some of the work you do for clients and other stuff just for you, or kind of what's the mix of that?
It's a lot of for work, a few things just for myself, like this console probably wouldn't be something that we would fix at my work, because I don't know, maybe tomorrow we'll get another one of these at work and I'll rebuild it. But this was a personal project, but it's mostly for work. Every once in a while, I'll do a console or a really old audio processor that, you know, we might not fix at my job or whatever, because, you know, for whatever reason. And so I don't know, maybe a 50-50 ratio or so.
Okay.
It's not really for myself, but just for the enjoyment. It's all for fun.
Now, when you told me that you rebuilt a Sparta console, I'm going like, wow, really? Is Sparta consoles worth rebuilding?
Well,
I remember those were not the most high performance consoles. Lots of noise. They weren't the quietest things in the world. And the buttons were just frankly awful. So tell me about why. Why did you rebuild a Sparta console?
Okay. I think the main reason that I could give is that was my first pot board, as I called it. You know, had round pots instead of faders like this guy here.
Okay.
And that was a gift from John Clark. He gave it to me along with a BE Spotmaster, the mono four pot version. Those two were together.
Yes,
I fixed both of them. The BE worked just fine, but the Sparta would not come back. It had a bunch of leaky caps and then a bunch of really bad switches. And they weren't the shadow switches like this. They were just the solid plastic things at the top of each channel. And most of those were broken. Pots were missing. Channel pots were completely busted. And I think that's when my interest in broadcast electronics, it moved on from consumer electronics like tube radios and tube amps, solid state stuff, and, you know, speakers and things. It began to go into broadcast equipment with that Sparta console. So it's kind of funny. Most people started with a Sparta console in their professional career. And and in my hobby side of things, I started with the Sparta because that was what was given to me. And I made it work. It was a lot of work. And most of the paint is missing off the front. And it looks like it went through a third world war. But it actually sounds pretty good, even though it probably shouldn't. But hey, that was my first broadcast console, and I didn't know any better. I didn't have a PR&E at the time. If I had this and a Sparta, I would pick this up, put it in my little car, and run away from the Sparta if I could. But no offense to
Was the Sparta mono or stereo?
It was stereo. I think it's an AS30B, if I'm thinking of the right thing. I think it was 8 or 10 channels, and it works great. It's still on the air back home. So,
and it had rotary pots. Now, one of the problems that we often saw with rotary pot stereo consoles was the left and there were two pots on the same shaft, and the left and right volume levels would not track each other. Now, if you had the step if you had the step attenuators, those were great. I mean, they would go up in steps, but they were always within a couple dB of each other as they would go up or down. Wasn't a big problem.
Yeah.
But man, these rotary pots that used, you know, carbon or plastic pots, not good tracking.
No, and I'm not really trying to talk down on Mod Pots. They are good. This thing's full of them. All these little pots right here are Mod Pots. But when they're used for the actual channel fader day in, day out, when those things start working loose and, you know, the resistance track inside starts wearing apart unevenly, nothing on that board fades evenly. But, you know, you'd pull up a mic channel and you'd have more in the right, and then you'd pull it back a little bit and it'd be the opposite. And it's a big OCD nightmare, but it worked.
OCD nightmare. It worked. That's the truth. Oh my.
If you try to select a different source, you know, how these certain switch banks will, you know, A, B, and C input for each channel, you'd select A, and then let's say B was previously selected, it would pop B back out. This thing would shoot the buttons at you.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was being shot at.
Let's move to cart machines. You like to rebuild these ITC Delta machines, and I recall those. Mm-hmm. That was the last, if not the last, one of the last, you know, model runs that they had for yep. quite a few years. I rebuilt a bunch of the premium decks, the ones with the brushed aluminum front. They were heavy as all get oh, yeah. out, and it was a lot of capacitors, both in the audio circuit and the big can capacitors in the power supply, the ones you could hurt yourself on if you touched them at the wrong time.
Oh, yeah.
And then a lot of bearing replacement. So tell me how, and head replacement, pinch roller replacement, what were the rebuilding the ITC Deltas like?
Pretty straightforward. There's only been a few of them I've worked with. I don't really work with cart machines all that often. I have a few for in the studio in here. Once I get like a little platform, I can put them on above the meter bridge. But it was a lot of really straightforward, pretty much like this. A lot of contact cleaner and a lot of re-soldering broken solder joints, replacing motor bearings when I could find the right ones, and of course, lots of cap replacement. Pretty straightforward. Pretty much every one that I've gotten looked horrible when I got it, and it looked slightly less horrible, but sounded good when I was done. Because, you know, the paint would be missing around the start and stop buttons if they were present. Lots of help from friends. You know, they would have parts machines and they'd be like, hey, do you need a head stack for these, or do you need a motor or motor driver, or you know, it's just a lot of through hole component repair that these needed. But once you fixed them, they generally just run. So I think there's some logic circuit parts that were kind of hard to find here and there, but everything else is pretty straightforward with those.
Boy, ITC sure built a lot of good car machines. They would run and run and run. And when I was doing contract engineering, I always felt like, hey, I'm replacing all the electrolytic caps on this playback board, because they would dry out, and then you'd have all, you know, it would run through the queue, or the bass would, you know, disappear from the audio. And I always felt like I should be training somebody else how to do that. I never had an employee like you who I could have trained. Of course, you were a baby at the time, so that wouldn't work out.
If I even existed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What other tape machines have you enjoyed rebuilding, and kind of, you know, what any common themes in rebuilding, say, reel to reel machines? You've got an Otari next to you there.
Yeah. The two biggest models that I've worked with, and it's literally two models, the MX5050 here and the Ampex ATR 700. Once again, my first reel to reel was from my friend John in Thomasville, and it was an ATR 700. And that thing worked when I got it. I didn't have to do much to it. This one, on the other hand, didn't want to come back. You know, you turn it on and you hear stuff popping and cracking inside, and that would be the tantalum capacitors doing their usual dance. But yeah, aside from like relapping heads and finding tape that doesn't shed when you use it, straightforward. A few cap replacements here and there, and they just work. So three or four of these I've rebuilt, and I've only worked on one or two ATR 700s, one for me and one for someone else.
I had to remind myself what the ATR 700 looked like, and I just looked it up and realized, oh, I fixed a bunch of those too.
Yeah.
They were pretty good decks. I'm not going to do the whole story, but, you know, one time I fixed a beautiful Otari MX5050B, like what you got there. I fixed the whole thing, and I fixed it for free for a client. Do you know why I fixed it for free? Because
why is that?
I'm the goofy schlob that spilled Coke in it. Yeah. Here I was always, you know, saying, no drinks in the control room, none in the production room. I was in the production room, and I didn't usually even bring a Coke into the room. I don't know why I did that day, but there was the can of Coke next to the Otari. And these were laying horizontal. They weren't up on a nice thing like it wouldn't have happened if I had a mount like that, you know, the rack like you have there. No, these were laying flat in the top of the furniture, and I knocked the Coke over, and it wasn't a lot of Coke, but it was enough that it wasn't going to work right if I didn't clean it out. So yeah, I spent the next 4 hours on my own dime taking the thing apart and just getting every. None of it fell on electronics. It was all on mechanical stuff.
So. Oh, okay. Well, that's luck right there.
Luck was with me that day. I tried real hard to break my luck, but I didn't. Now, audio processors are another thing that you like to rebuild. You mentioned the Orbin 8000. That's been a very popular box for people to rebuild and to retrofit with better chips, better ICs. Talk to me about how your procedure for looking at an Orbin 8000.
Well, there's not really any real straightforward procedure with those. I just look at it and say, is the front door there? That's usually missing. It has the OptiMod name on it. Dried out caps is the number one thing. Bad op amps in the input section. Usually they get blown out because these are, most of the 8000s that I came across were fed from telephone lines or STLs or whatever. And not really any real procedure. Just there's a few modifications that just involves swapping out op amps for different lower noise, faster op amps. And of course, the biggest thing is the stereo generator alignment. That and the 8100 are probably two of my most favorite audio processors. The 8100 is actually, I think, a little bit more fun to work on. There's more to it. Same thing there. Caps and better op amps.
And I've done a lot of the exact same things you have. I'm sure other people watching or listening to the show have too. Replaced caps in the power supply and on the board. Replaced chips with, chips with a lower noise, higher slew rate. And the one thing that has frustrated me, because it was more difficult to replace and disappointing when it happened, it seemed that on both the 8000 and 8100, there was a variable capacitor with very coarse, thin mica sheets in it. I've just touched and turned that while looking at it on a spectrum analyzer to get these spurs down and it would just break apart. The mica sheets would just fall off, and now I didn't have a capacitor.
Oh yeah,
I instantly ruined a capacitor. Did you ever have that happen to you?
Yeah, a couple different times when I'm realigning the stereo generator or if I'm just looking at it and I'm handling the board and the thing just falls off, that's happened before. And there's modern replacements for that. Mauser and DigiKey have them.
Oh, good.
It's frustrating because then, the stereo generator that worked before you touched it and now it no longer will work the components fell off or, it won't stay. Like you'll adjust it a certain way and then the pressure of you removing your tool that you adjust it with changed it they're so sensitive that once you get them right, they generally just work, especially the 8100 stereo generator.
Yeah. It's funny how times have changed, because back when I was fixing those, we didn't have the internet. And so we had, thick paper catalogs and such. But one time I had several failed components in the stereo generator of an 8100. And I called up Orbin and told them, hey, I need to buy these parts. And the guy on the phone suggested, yeah, you probably also need these couple of parts too. He said, we'll get those shipped to you. I said, well, now money's an issue here. I don't have an unlimited budget. He says, no, we're going to ship them for free. You'll get them in a couple days. Huh? Really?
Wow.
Yeah. This would have been back in the mid 80s. This would have been like 1985, 86. Their policy at the time, or maybe they were just being nice to me, but I think their policy at the time was, look, if it's, under 20, 30 bucks worth of parts, we're just going to ship them to you because it's cheaper to do that than for us to handle your credit card. Well, that was back when credit cards were handled with a machine that did like this.
Right. It was a whole process. That's really cool.
It was a process. I appreciated that back then. Now it's so easy. It's much easier for companies to take your money. So they do. So Texar Audio Prisms. This was something it's been of interest to you. Tell me about refurbishing those.
My interest in Texar Prisms kind of started whenever I was living in Georgia for a while. There is a radio station. Let me think of the call signs. There's so many call signs they get all mixed together, but there's Cruisin 94 WMTM. I think until recently still had Texar Prisms on the air, and most stations in that area were, digital processors, and those all usually sound really good. But there was something about the sound of this radio station, because I listen to the radio a lot. I don't hardly stream very much unless I'm in an area with, just bad stations. And I always noticed that this station had like an odd, not odd, but just a different character to its sound, maybe. It was warmer, if you could think of it that way, and a little bit not as loud. I figured out that they were using prisms. And once I figured out what those mystery devices were, I'd already been interested in 8100s and the XT chassis and all that. I was like, oh my gosh, another device to stick in front of the 8100 to make it work even better for the most part. And it was weird because once I started figuring out what Texar Prisms were, It's like everybody started giving them to me. I had probably 15 or 20 of them sitting by this table back here one time. I have a picture.
Wow.
I'll send it to you later.
What
I had
a
stack
mine.
Of CRLs and a stack of Texar Prisms next to each other. And they were various versions, the Gentner versions and the original Monroeville versions. Those are kind of a pain to make work again. There's a pretty interesting alignment procedure if you've ever looked at a Texar Prism. It's made up of a motherboard and a power supply, and you have four processor modules. And most of it is the display driver. And there's a Vactrol, a little opto-isolator, and those drift with age. Mm-hmm. Some of them do, some of them don't. It's weird. I would come across certain pairs of prisms that would work fine just perfectly, and then I would come across some sets that would I'd have to beat to death to make work right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you would align it with this really odd alignment procedure, and I'm sure most of you know what I'm talking about. You'd leave, go get your coffee, and come back, and they would be different. It's like somebody went in there and messed with it again. You know, they would drift like crazy. But once you got them, there is a sound that the prisms can make that I find most digital processors can kind of get close to, but just, I don't know, maybe it's a placebo effect of having all those LEDs flashing across the top that makes it better. If you're tired, or I don't know how to put it, but if you're tired and it's end of the day and you're looking at your air chain or whatever, and you just kind of zone out, just staring at the LEDs while listening to the music or whatever, it is mesmerizing. There's a saying in the manual. If you actually look at the Prism manual, it's funny. I don't know what the saying is, but it's like looking at the display, there's a wealth of knowledge that could be, you know, taken in from looking at the displays, and it's funny.
But yeah. Not only a wealth of knowledge,
they're a lot of fun. I love Prism.
Hypnotic effect. Hey, we're going to we're going to cover one more topic real quick and then break and come back with our tip of the week. And that topic is about more modern digital audio processors. And one thing that you and I had talked about is with modern digital processors, so often the actual guts of the processor that actually handles the digital signal processing, so often that just keeps working fine. Your problems are things like your power supply and your input and output chips, you know, circuits, and the display. So talk to me about your experiences a bit in refurbishing, fixing digital audio processors.
Okay, so just one example that kind of applies to a bunch of them. We get a lot of OptiMods in, analog and digital, and almost always the actual DSP side of the digital processors usually just work just fine. There's never any problem with them unless lightning got in there. But a lot of times the displays would fail, so you couldn't actually make adjustments. You know, you could toggle around with the buttons and stuff, but you don't know what you're clicking. You can't make adjustments to your multiband. You can't make adjustments to your sound or anything. You know, stereo generator adjustments. You can't do that with the display not working unless you're able to log into it either through USB or serial port or something like that. But a lot of processors that we come across that are digital, it's usually just simple stuff. Switch mode supplies have blown caps in them, or input op amps have been cooked from lightning or whatever. But most of the time it's just simple things like displays. For the most part, they just work. It's where it's all, you know, it's just a program that a small computer or a small processor runs. It's pretty what's what I'm looking for, just uniform, and it doesn't drift with age that much. But it's the simple stuff, you know. Input op amps, output op amps, and displays. Lots of display replacements. We actually have an 8400 on the bench right now that's has a display issue that we need to fix.
Sure enough, the unit works fine.
Just can't see what's going on the screen.
I will tell you, you know, for manufacturers, my own experience and that of others, it's hard to source a display that is made as long as you want to make the product. Manufacturers change. I mean, at my employer, one of the things, you know, it seems like we're frequently having to do is change our firmware, software, and display driver circuitry to accommodate, oh, that display is no longer available. Now we have to move to this display. Yeah. A lot of this is driven by the automotive industry and the industrial industry. Whatever they want, you know, that's what gets made. So, wow.
Sure.
We're talking to Jordan Tuck. He is an expert A young expert, he says, nah, I'm not an expert. I said, no, dude, you're an expert.
I'm still learning.
Well, good. We all should be. Mike Patton should still be learning. I'm sure he is. On This Week in Radio Tech, Jordan's with us. I'm Kirk Harnack here in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. We're going to come back with a tip of the week where Jordan is going to just blow our socks off with a great idea. Aren't you, Jordan? Did I tell you about this, Jordan? Yeah, maybe I didn't. Sorry. He's going to come back with an idea, maybe a website, maybe a tool, maybe, hey, folks, don't go to all the trouble. Just send your box to me. I'll make it right, and I'll send you a bill and send it back on This Week in Radio Tech. Okay, our show is brought to you in part by Josh Bone and our friends at Max Connect Wireless, because the stuff works. We'll be right back.
I'm Gary Morrow, Midwest Regional Director of Engineering for Alpha Media. When I first spoke with Josh Bone about Max Connect, he told me they'd work great for remote transmitter sites where connectivity was a challenge. And you know, he's absolutely right. We even have sites where we're using this as a backup to our STL using Max Connect's dual carrier option, and it works perfectly. We also have times where we need to be able to get out to a venue where it's kind of challenging because everybody and his brother is trying to stream video at the same time, like at a big sporting event. And you know what? Our data gets through every time because it's prioritized packet data. It works for us. It'll work for you. Max Connect. Check it out.
Gary is absolutely right. Max Connect Wireless, the stuff works, and you can get to your Max Connect on any of the carriers that you prefer. If you happen to know that AT&T or Verizon or T-Mobile or Sprint maybe has the best coverage in your area, great. You go with that carrier. Max Connect Wireless has deals with each of these carriers to provide prioritized data, prioritized over all the other schmucks out there who are doing their Facebook updates or streaming live video. You get your video through at maxconnectwireless.com. I know it's spelled funny, so look at how it's spelled. We'll put a link in the show notes so you can grab onto Max Connect. And I'm telling you, stuff works. Take it to remote broadcast, take it to the transmitter site. Hey, our show is also brought to you in part by Angry Audio. You know, with so many people broadcasting from home nowadays, maybe you do a podcast, maybe you're an engineer who's asked to help someone to improve their podcast studio. This is what you want in your back pocket. Actually, you want this right up front. This is the Angry Audio Bluetooth gadget. It's just awesome because you put this in your room, in your studio, and you hook it up. There's the connections right on the back there. You hook it up to your audio console, the Gazindas and the Gazadas, and you can put your phone, your cell phone, your smartphone on the air on your audio console. You can have a two-way conversation and have that come through on the audio console correctly with great audio from the caller. You can also play high-quality audio from your cell phone onto this. So if you've gone out and done an interview, for example, well, and it's on your phone, well, no need to mess around with getting the file off of there and getting it into a computer and then playing it back. You don't have to do all that. Just play it directly from your cell phone. You're going to get high-quality audio. And the thing is, the Bluetooth audio gadget from Angry Audio knows which mode to use it in, either in the two-way mode for a phone conversation where the quality's lower, but you get two-way. That's a standard thing in Bluetooth, or in the one-way direction with the high-quality mode. Check it out. It's angryaudio.com. There's a picture of it from the product page, angryaudio.com. They make all kinds of things to make your studio better and better and better. And they also have all those Studio Hub adapters. So if you need some cables, adapters, Studio Hub, they've got them because they are Studio Hub now at angryaudio.com. All right. It's Kirk Harnack. Jordan Tuck is here. And Jordan, put you on the spot. I'm sorry. Did I forget to mention this?
It's all good.
We'd like to get a tip of the week. What would you like to leave our listeners with?
Let me think about this for just a split second. Just because it's old doesn't mean it's bad. If some engineers I know would look at this console and they would be horrified if this was on the air. Oh my gosh, I can't rely on that. Yes, you can if you actually rebuild it correctly. It's not much of a tip, but I'm just saying, you know, just because it's old and just because it might be out of production doesn't make it necessary to replace it with the latest, greatest thing, even though going digital and going with modern equipment is probably the best thing. That's my sort of a tip, if you will.
Oh, no, it's a great
just
tip.
Just because, you know, it's ancient.
At my own radio stations, we are all audio over IP in the studios just because it's great to be able to remote in and do that. The quality is great. But some of our STLs are still very old. In fact, Mike Patton has repaired a few of our STLs, and they just sit there and run and run and run. And yet the companies that made them, in a couple of cases, are out of business, have been for years. And companies like the guy you work with, Mike Patton, keeps this stuff running. You source, hey, if you have to make a new board, if it's a popular enough failure, right? Mike may design a board to fix the problem and find sources for parts that are often non-obtainium. So you're right. Some things are worth keeping going.
Yeah. If you have something that's old and it doesn't even really have to be old, but just something that might be out of production or not supported, we can probably fix it where I work. And it's a lot of fun. So yeah.
Good deal.
That's kind of my tip.
We'll put a link to you and Mike Patton in our show notes today. And hey, we might even put a Scotty Rice link in there too, since he does a lot of this stuff. All right, folks, we got to go. I really appreciate Jordan. I appreciate you being with us. I look forward to an incredible career as you finally, grow old enough to have a beard. Sorry.
I could if I wanted to. I just usually keep it. It's the wife. She doesn't want me to have a beard, so. Blame her.
You're so young, and I'm delighted that you're in our business, and thank you for bringing your talents and your passion for doing this to our industry. That's really cool.
I couldn't have done it without all the supportive people that around me, and the list is too long really to go through. But you know who you are. If you've helped me by giving me a piece of gear that I didn't need, or teaching me something, or being patient with me as I learn, I really appreciate
it. Deal.
It's an honor to be with you.
And we should be thankful, to all those people, all those Elmers out there, as they call them in the ham radio world. All right, we got to go. I'm Kirk Harnack. Thanks a lot to all of our sponsors. And hey, I would appreciate it if you would patronize our sponsors. Let them know that you hear our show, that you're a fan, and we're going to come right back and do it again next week and the next week and the next week. So we're going to look for you on future episodes of This Week in Radio Tech. Big thanks to Suncast, our producer, for handling the show production duties every week. Thanks a lot. Also, thanks to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, home for lots of other fine podcasts. We're going to see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.